This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and I want to continue talking about orchids, this unusual and most often beautiful flower. Orchids have diverse and unflower-like looks. One species looks just like a German shepherd dog with its tongue sticking out. One species looks like an onion. One looks like an octopus. One looks like a human nose. One looks like a kind of fancy shoes that a king might wear. One looks like Mickey Mouse. One looks like a monkey. One looks dead. One was described in 1845 Botanical Registry as looking like, quote, an old-fashioned headdress peeping over one of those starched high collars such as ladies wore in the days of Queen Elizabeth, or through a horse collar decorated with gaudy ribbons. So this is, again, Susan Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief. And she continues, there are species that look like butterflies, bats, ladies' handbags, bees, swarms of bees, female wasps, clamshells, roots, camel horses, hooves, squirrels, nuns dressed in their wimples, and drunken old men. The genus Dracula is a blackish red that looks like a vampire bat. There's another one that looks like a ghost, but has also been described as looking like a bandy-legged dancer, a white frog, and a fairy. Many wild orchids in Florida have common names based on their looks, such as twisted, shiny-leafed, cowhorn, lips, snake, leafless-beaked, rat-tail, mule-ear, shadow witch, or water spider, false water spider, ladies' tresses, and false ladies' tresses. In 1678, the botanist Jacob Brain wrote, the manifold shape of these flowers arouses our highest admiration. They take on the forms of little birds, lizards, insects. They look like a man, like a woman, sometimes like an austere, sinister fighter, sometimes like a clown who excites our laughter. They represent the image of a lazy tortoise or a melancholy toad, an agile, ever-chattering monkey. Orchids have always been thought of as beautiful but strange. A wildflower guide published in 1917 called them queer freaks. The smallest orchids are microscopic, and the biggest ones have masses of flowers as large as footballs. Botanists have reported seeing a cowhorn orchid in Fetahatchee Swamp with normal-sized flowers and 34 pseudobulbs, which the bulging, tuber-shaped growths at the base of the plant where energy is stored. Each one is over 10 inches long. Some orchid flowers have petals as soft as powder, and other species have flowers rigid and rubbery as inner tubes. Raymond Chandler, the mystery writer who writes about Nero Wolfe, who owns thousands of orchids, wrote that orchids have the texture of human flesh. Orchids' colors are extravagant. They can be freckled or mottled or veiny or solid, from nearly neon to spotless white. Most species are more than one color. They'll have ivory petals and a hot pink lip, maybe, or green petals with burgundy stripes, or yellow petals with olive speckles, and a purple lip with a smear of red underneath. Some orchids have color combinations you wouldn't be caught dead wearing. Some look like the results of an accident involving paint. There are white orchids, but there is no such thing as a black orchid, even though people have been wanting a black orchid forever. It was black orchid extract that Basil St. John, the comic book character, Brenda Starr, needed in order to control his rare, mysterious blood disease. I once asked Bob Fuchs, the owner of RF Orchids in Homestead, Florida, if he thought a black orchid would ever be discovered or be produced by hybridizing. No. Never in real life, he said, only in Brenda Starr. Many plants pollinate themselves, which guarantees that they will reproduce and keep their species alive. The disadvantage of self-pollination is it recycles some of the same genetic material over and over, so self-pollinating species endure but don't evolve or improve themselves. Self-pollinating plants remain simple, common weeds. The orchid family could have died out like dinosaurs if insects had chosen to feed on simpler plants and not orchids. The orchids wouldn't have been pollinated, and without pollination, they would never have grown seeds. while self-pollinating simple plants grown nearby would have seeded themselves constantly and spread like mad and taken up more and more space and light and water, and eventually orchids would have been pushed to the margins of evolution and disappeared. Instead, orchids have multiplied and diversified and have become the biggest flowering plant family on Earth because each orchid species has made itself irresistible. Many species look so much like their favorite insects that the insect mistakes them for kin, and when it lands on the flower to visit, pollen sticks to its body. In a book about orchids by an orchid collector, in Madagascar, there must be moths with proboscis capable of extension to a length of 10 or 12 inches. This belief of mine has been ridiculed by some entomologists, but we now know from Fritz Müller that there is a sphinx moth in South Brazil which has a proboscis of nearly sufficient length. For when dried out, it was between 10 and 11 inches long. When not protruded, the proboscis is coiled up in a spiral of at least 20 windings. Some huge moth with a wonderfully long proboscis could drain the last drop of nectar. If such great moths become extinct in Madagascar, surely certain orchids would become extinct as well. Darwin was very interested in how orchids released pollen. He experimented by poking them with needles, camel hair brushes, bristles, pencils, and his fingers. He discovered that parts were so sensitive that they released pollen upon the slightest touch, but that moderate degrees of violence on the less sensitive parts had no effect, which he concluded meant that the orchid wouldn't release pollen haphazardly. It was smart enough to save it for only the most favorable encounters with bugs. He wrote, "Orchids appeared to have been modeled in the wildest caprice, but this, no doubt, is due to our ignorance of their requirements and conditions of life." Why do orchids have so many perfect contrivances for their fertilization? I am sure that many other plants offer analogous adaptations of high perfection, but it seems they are really more numerous and perfect with Orchidaceae than most other plants. Some species of orchids grow in the ground, others don't live in soil at all. The ones that don't grow in soil are called epiphytes, and they live their lives attached to a tree branch or a rock. Epiphytic orchids' seeds settle in a comfortable spot, sprout, grow, dangle their roots in the air, and live a lazy life absorbing rainwater and decayed leaves and light. They aren't parasites. They give nothing to the tree and get nothing from it except a good place to sit. Most epiphytes evolved in tropical jungles where so many living things compete for the jungle floor that most species lose the fight and die out. Being an orchid hunter has always meant pursuing beautiful things in terrible places. From the mid-1800s to the early 1900s, when orchid hunting was at its prime, terrible places were really terrible places, and any man advertising himself as a hunter needed to be hardy, sharp, and willing to die from home. No one in England is very good at cultivating or breeding tropical orchids at the time, so hunters were on the way to get nursery stock, let alone new species. The large nurseries implied crews of hunters. In 1894, for instance, the preeminent Victorian orchid grower Frederick Saunder had 60 greenhouses at his estate in St. Albans, employed 23 hunters, collecting around the world for him, including a man in Mexico, two in Brazil, two in Colombia, two in Peru, one in Madagascar, one in New Guinea, three in India, one in the Strait Settlement. One of Sander's best hunters was Benedict Rotzel, a tough-looking Czech. Rotzel had cut off his left hand accidentally while in Havana demonstrating a machine that he invented for extracting fiber from hemp. The iron hook he used took its place, added to his grim appearance. Rotzel combed across South America and discovered 800 new orchid species in his travel. At its peak of Victorian orchid fever, There were scores of orchid hunters crisscrossing the world for different growers. In 1993, three poachers were arrested in the Everglades with a haul of alpine silk butterflies, a species that had sold for $37,000 in Japan. In Fakahatchee Swamp, rangers are kept busy arresting hunters for hunting deer illegally at night for using a stunning floodlight. Alligators vanish all the time. Recently, two men were arrested in the Loxahatchee for killing an alligator. They'd shot it dead, cut off a 29-inch piece of its tail, loaded it into a canoe, then somehow capsized their canoe and got into a fight over which of them had caused the canoe to tip over. When the rangers arrested them, they were still in the middle of the fight. Many people in the orchid world knew about certain successes with the ghost orchids, but people got calls all the time from those who wanted to buy one. That week, the woman working with the ghost orchid had already gotten a call from Tampa, a call from California. The woman in California told Savalia that she was desperate for a ghost orchid and how much Savalia wanted one of hers. "I told her $100," Savalia said honestly. "I could have given $1,000. "It's not really about collecting the thing itself," LaRoche once told me. "It's about getting immersed in something and learning about it and having it become part of your life. It's a kind of direction." He stopped on the word direction and chortled. "If anyone had a plant I don't have, I made sure to get it. It was like a heroin addiction. If I ever had money, I would spend it on plants. When my wife and I had our nursery, we had 40,000 just totally unimaginable plants." "What was your favorite?" Susan Orlean asked him. He scuffled his heel in the dirt. "I think it would have to be a little gorgeous ginger plant a friend got me in New Zealand. It had first been collected 100 years ago, and I think I had the only one in cultivation. It had tiny round leaves, sort of brownish, with silver chevron markings, and I swear it looked like it was made out of crystal." Then all of the sorriness hardened into something less stifling, and I suddenly decided I would rather walk, no matter which way we went, than to sit here, idle and frantic, spinning my mind like a tire in the sand. I knew LaRoche wanted me to see a ghost orchid as much or even more than I wanted to see it myself. But now I really, most of all, wanted to go home. At this point, I realized it was just as well that I never see a ghost orchid, so that it could never disappoint me. It would remain forever something I wanted to see. And then in an interview that Susan Orlean gave people, an interview of her, she says, "There was a great piece years ago written by Janet Malcolm that argued there is a mutually exploitative relationship between a reporter and a subject. I have to agree with her. That does not mean that it's evil and corrupt. It just means that to not acknowledge that you are using each other for a reason, in other words, the reporter and the person being interviewed, and that it's this context of relationship is not a natural relationship. It's a very unnatural relationship. You're not having a friendship with John LaRoche. You're having a relationship with the context of a reporter. I don't think it means that it's false. It means that you always are aware that it's an unusual circumstance." Then the questioner asked her, "Have you ever been smitten by a subject?" And Susan Orlean answered, "Yes. He was a show dog. I fell in love with him, but he was a tough subject to interview." This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.